You're listening to a podcast on the Audio Boom Network. This is Walk the Talk with me, Dave Thomas. Thank you for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it. In these podcasts, I will be talking with people who share their stories of tragedy and hope. I will be exploring mental health and well-being with workplace professionals and also with folk who have struggled to make sense of their own lives. My hope is that these shared experiences will remove the loneliness from those people who are convinced it is their fate to suffer alone. I'm Dave Thomas, and I've been a serving police officer for over 20 years. You're very welcome to join me on Walk the Talk. Lieutenant Colonel Will Meddings is an infantry officer in the Royal Anglian Regiment. Throughout his career, he's commanded soldiers on operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, in teams sizing from 12-man patrols fighting alongside the Afghan army in Helmand to a 100-strong company protecting advisers in Kabul. He now commands a battalion of 500 soldiers. In 2016, Will was one of the founders of the Centre for Army Leadership at the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, a small organisation designed to improve leadership across the British Army. Around the same time, he also set up the Army Leader, a leadership development website sharing practical leadership advice for junior leaders. It now has over 150 visitors a year. So join us now as Will discusses the role of the Army Leader and the delicate skill of balancing the task, the team and the individual, and also discusses the difference between the armed services and the police. Lieutenant Colonel Will Meddings, a very warm welcome to Walk the Talk. Perhaps you could give us a quick overrun of your military career to date and your involvement in the Centre for Army Leadership.
Yeah, of course, Dave. So I've been in the British Army for about 17 years. In that time, I have been an infantry commander for almost all of that. That's seen me training soldiers to go on operations and leading those soldiers on operations as well. First as a young platoon commander in Iraq around 2006, and then variously over the years, three more tours of Afghanistan. And those have been fascinating experiences in terms of leading groups of men and women from a team of about 12 all the way through to a company of around 150, most recently in Afghanistan. And I'm currently commanding an infantry battalion, about 500 soldiers. My interest in leadership, other than the obvious interest that's required for any infantry leader, is it's something that began when I was working for 2 years at Sandhurst. So I came back from Afghanistan in 2015 and was posted to Sandhurst to set up the Centre for Army Leadership. Myself and an academic called Lloyd Clark. And Lloyd and I started to look at what it meant to be a good leader, to consider how we could create an organization that would encourage good leadership in the army. I say encourage, I really mean, you know, improve the good leadership that's already out there. And that was a fantastic period of time because it allowed us to really examine these questions and work out what do you do to take a group of people who care passionately about leadership, as all leaders in the British Army do. But how do you improve that? How do you create that great conversation between academia and practice? How do you make people think, actually, I can read a lot of books, but what makes me actually lead better? And as part of that, I worked on setting up a leadership website called The Army Leader, which again looked at people sharing their own leadership experiences, because the reality is a lot of the way we learn about leadership is by looking at others' experiences, deciding what we want to copy, deciding what we don't want to copy. And so sharing experiences online is a really important way of, I guess you could say, more widely mentoring other leaders. I think that's a really, really important part of what we try to do at the Centre for Army Leadership. And I think an important job of every leader is to develop the next generation. That's a really key role.
Okay, so essentially a simple question, but I suspect the answer may be considerably more complex. What makes a good leader?
Well, I'll start off by giving you the Army's view. So around 2016, 2017, the Army published its leadership doctrine. And the leadership doctrine That's quite a military phrase. You might more easily call it a leadership handbook. Was about 80-page booklet, which talked about the army's experiences of what worked and what didn't work in leadership. And broadly speaking, it described a good leader as someone who knows what leaders are, what leaders know, and what leaders do. So, what do we mean by what leaders are? Well, you know, a good leader is someone who's a role model, who is selfless, who essentially provides a sort of figurehead for an organization that people want to follow. And that is somewhat the character of a leader. You know, you need a leader who's got character, who's trusted by the people who are beneath them. That's what the army talks as what leaders are. What leaders know is about the technical skills, and some of that's decision making, some of that's communicating, but also in order to be trusted by the people you're trying to lead, you've got to have the technical skills that are required. And that's the same in the army or in the police force. You can only lead if you know the skills that are required of your role. That doesn't mean you need to know the skills of all the people beneath you, although it sometimes does, but you've got to know the skills that you need to do. And the last thing is what leaders do, and that's the practical application. And for that, the army looks back to John Adair's theory of action-centered leadership. And it talks about a leader having to balance three competing needs. That's the needs of the team. How do you build a team and keep the team together, building team cohesion? How do you achieve the task? And for Adair, that was the most important role. You know, a team comes together to achieve a task. And then finally, how do you look after the individuals, grow the individuals, and make sure their individual needs are catered for? And that model requires a leader to balance those three things. And at some times they will be focused on the task, at other times they'll need to build a team, at other times they'll need to look after individuals. But it's a balancing act that that every leader has to think about. And I always like that model, because whilst it's quite old, it sort of goes back to the 60s and 70s, it actually reminds a leader that if you focus purely on the task, then you almost have an IOU that you've written to the team to bring the team together and the individuals. And periodically, the good of the task is best served by looking after the team and looking after the individuals if you take a longer-term view. So that's sort of the army's view of what leadership is. I guess if you were going to ask me about my personal view, I think my time thinking about leadership in the British Army has led me to the conclusion that the centre of good leadership is building teams, first of all. And why would I say that? We tend to think of teams as a group of people who've come together to achieve a task. That's kind of the simplest definition. But I think a really good team, a team that's able to be led, is a group of people who have come together with a shared identity to achieve a task that they believe is the right thing for the team to achieve. And we talk a lot in the army about team cohesion and forging teams that can fight together. The reality is you can bring any group of people together to simply achieve a task, but if you want them to do it well and you want them to be led, the first task of the leader is to forge a group identity. And we all want to have group identities. Actually, as human beings, we really like that. When you join a particular force, you know, when you join a particular unit in the army, we try and come together. And there's loads of research into the psychology of it that says we look to be parts of groups, even when there's no group to be part of. So in some ways, you're pushing against an open door as a leader when you're trying to build an identity. But once a leader has built a really strong team identity, people feel they're part of something larger than them, you're then in a position to get people to give up something to achieve a greater task. So once a leader's forged a team, the next thing they need to do is ensure that they look after that team. That's the next circle of the next bit of part of a Dare circle. Look after the team, be selfless, essentially put the needs of the team before themselves. And then they're just sort of positioning themselves, making it really obvious to the people in the team that they are looking after those people and looking after the group identity. And if that sounds slightly Machiavellian, I hope it doesn't. But it means that if you're together creating a team, cohering a group of people together under a shared identity, as a leader, you have to put that identity before yourself. Because at that point, you can be trusted. At that point, you become a role model. At that point, people want to follow you because you're proving that you're in it for the team rather than yourself. And maybe we can talk about when it goes wrong for leaders. But if you are standing in front of people and telling them that everyone should work for the team and you're not working for the team as well, then people immediately see straight through you. And that's the point where it's difficult to lead. So building a team and putting that team first and explaining why the task is important, those are absolutely fundamental to a leader. That's what you need to do to be a good leader.
Well, just going back to what you said when you started your military career and you're in charge of a section of 12 colleagues and now you're over 500, obviously a lot of what you've just said will apply to both situations. Is there any differences between leading 12 men and women and 500?
Yeah, funnily enough, there are a lot of differences. But I think the underlying idea of building a team, selling that team the task, if you like, and looking after the individuals are exactly the same. There comes a point where a team grows beyond the size at which one individual can lead it. And the theory sort of suggests that's around 100 to 150 people. And if you look back over history, you can see that, you know, Roman centuries, you know, the idea, okay, I think they're actually a bit less than 100 people, but this idea of a company of soldiers being around 100 people seems to run through history because research suggests that's around the number at which people can know everybody in a group. You can recognize everybody's face, you can feel an affinity with people. So actually there are some really big similarities between leading a group of 100 to 150 people and leading a group of 12 people. You know, you can be a role model who looks out for the team in exactly the same way, it's just a bit more complex. I think when you move to an organization that's larger than 150 people, you will no longer see those people every day. You'll no longer recognize everybody. I don't recognize everybody in the battalion. It's simply impossible for me to do that. Instead, I will...
But everybody knows you.
Well, everybody may know me, but they may not meet me. They may meet me sort of once every 3 months. You know, that's the reality of the situation. I've been in the job for around 3 months now, and there are still people that I haven't met yet. But what that does mean is that you lead people who lead others. And it also hugely scales up the importance of the individual contacts that you have. So if I only meet somebody once in 3 months, that interaction is hugely important. And I think as leaders become more senior, that's one of the things they need to grasp, is that as you breach the 150 odd boundary, as you reach the point where you are leading people who will lead other people, you then need to act in an entirely different way. And at that point, well, not an entirely different way, you're still a team leader for the small group of people that you do interact with all the time. But you have to be aware that your interactions with those people you see rarely are much more symbolic, much more powerful. And I think there's a phrase that you probably use in police forensics that, you know, every touch leaves a fingerprint, or something similar to that anyway. And that is absolutely right. And those fingerprints are much deeper. I'm probably stretching the metaphor here a bit, but those fingerprints are much deeper when they happen less often. And as you become more senior, you've really got to understand that.
And we all have our bad days, don't we? And it's a good point that you raise. If the only contact you've had with somebody is every 3 months and you're on a bad day, that can leave a bad impression, can't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think that is beholden on a leader to ensure that they understand that if they're having a bad day, they may have to go and take themselves away and have a little moment. Having said that, that doesn't mean that single interaction you have doesn't need to be an aggressive or indeed an angry interaction. You know, there is a time when that one interaction is very rare, but when it happens, you're interacting to make sure you make people really clear that you're not happy with what's going on. I mean, this isn't all sunshine and light and hugs and kisses. The reality is sometimes things go wrong and you either have to interject in an aggressive manner or alternatively in a very angry manner. Those are skills in a leader's communication repertoire. Yeah, absolutely. But you have to be very careful about doing it unintentionally and understanding the effect that you have when you do those things.
Well, I think what's coming out from what you're saying as a good leader is that you have to be selfless, I suppose.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think, you know, Field Marshal Slim made the point about selflessness very well. You know, he put first he said you first put the needs of the mission first, then you put the needs of the team, and then sort of people and yourself. But his point was that it's always yourself last. And he reiterated that really heavily in the short quote of his, that you have to put yourself last. You have to be selfless, because you've created a team identity and asked everybody else to put themselves subordinate to the needs of the team. And as the leader, you have to do that even more so than everyone else. And that can take a toll on people, I think.
So now we know what makes a good leader, what stops us being one?
I think we've probably talked a little bit about it there. If we were to look at that idea of what leaders are, know and do, which is a great framework that the army has got, the first thing that what would stop you being a good leader is, of course, not knowing how to do all of the skills that are required. There is a requirement every time you assume a new leadership role that you have to learn the skills that are required to do that role. That's the same in the police, in the army, in any career. So don't underestimate, when you start a new role, the importance of actually knowing how to carry that job out. That seems a rather basic thing, but it's a leadership leadership factor as well as just a simple competence factor. And then you need to know how to make decisions, and then you need to know how to communicate. And if you can't communicate or you can't make decisions, and if you haven't got the professional skills, then it's very difficult for you to lead. So I think falling short in any of those three, you know, I'd recommend anybody coming into a new leadership role to consider those three. Are you a good enough communicator? Do you know how to make decisions? And I mean, you know, can you think about assessing options and deciding to do something? And then the basic sort of functional competence are really important. What else stops people from being a good leader? What leaders are, the character element, yep, the selflessness, being a role model. You know, we all hate leaders who say one thing and do something else. It's an absolute classic of bad leadership. So you need to be aware that, you know, the spotlight is always on you. You're always on parade. And so to that extent, what else stops us from being good leaders? The fact that we are tempted to do differently to what we tell people to do, to cut corners or to break rules that we've set ourselves. And that, again, you know, people won't follow somebody like that. And I think the last bit, and sometimes the challenging bit, is understanding the dynamic of what leaders do, balancing the team, the task, and the individual together. It's very easy, especially when you're under pressure, for the task to always come first. And you can probably sustain that for a pretty long period of time and then leave your job, hand it over to somebody else. And at the end of that well-achieved task, you have an unhappy team full of unhappy individuals. And you get to walk off into the sunset looking very impressive, and the person who follows on has to pick up the pieces. So understanding when the task is more important than building the team, and when the task is less important than looking after individuals, that's really important.
I was smiling when he was saying that, and I remember reading last year about personal qualities, and without courage there can be no other qualities. Everything takes courage, and decision making as a leader, and as you just alluded to, sometimes between the task and the team, that takes courage, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And in the army we talk about two types of courage. We talk about moral courage as well as physical courage. And I think physical courage is the most obvious one that we expect of people, and it's perhaps the one that's most associated with the military when we look at, you know, people who are awarded medals for gallantry. The reality is that moral courage is equally as important, if not more important, because it's the moral courage that makes sure you can do the right thing. It's the moral courage that underpins the selflessness at all times. So there is a danger if we select in any career, if we select for physical courage over moral courage, there's a danger we're doing the wrong thing. Clearly both are required, but I think that the emphasis is really on moral courage. And somebody I worked with several years ago talked about the Moran's old adage that courage is like a bank balance, and you can only continually withdraw from the bank balance until you run out of it. And that's his view of courage. But actually, as this guy was saying, he looks at moral courage separately, and that moral courage is different in the more you draw on it and the more you use your moral courage, actually the more you have. That every time you do the wrong thing, it becomes easier to do the wrong thing. So actually there's a bit of positive reinforcement here. People who use their moral courage need to be helped out to continually use their moral courage to become stronger and stronger and reinforce that they're doing the right thing, so that we can build that skill up in our people.
So in a command and control environment, failure in a crisis can be catastrophic. How should we view failure? And just as importantly, how should we address it when it occurs?
Talking about failure and what we learn from failure is a pretty trendy topic at the moment. There are loads of really interesting books on the subject of psychological safety and learning from failure. And all of those, I think, are really important. I guess the Army's in a slightly different position to the police force in that we go through periods of training to deploy in operations, and when you're training, you're in a learning environment, and therefore the tolerance for getting something wrong is perhaps higher than it is on operations. That said, of course, during training people are still injured and sadly people get killed, and therefore there are some failures that you can't tolerate happening. But I think when you think about how you view failure, there's negligence, which is one kind of failure, and I don't think anyone would suggest that negligence is acceptable. you know, when people are, when people negligently fail, when they don't carry out their task, then that has consequences. And it has consequences because when we talk about being a role model and setting an example, sometimes as a leader, people who are negligent and fail have to be held to account for absolutely the right reasons. But you can also look at failure as an amazing learning opportunity. And then you have to get into this question of how the failure matters. You know, when we're training, I actually want my people to push the envelope of their ability repeatedly, always pushing to try something more difficult, always pushing to try something that's new. And of course, if they do that, they're going to fail. And if you delegate to people to help them grow and develop, and you push people into difficult circumstances, people will fail. And it's important they understand this difference between failing because they've tried something new in an environment where failure is acceptable, or failure is at a cost of trying to do better. You know, failure was a risk that was accepted, versus failing in an area where it is legally incorrect or people's lives were unnecessarily put at risk. And I think understanding the difference between those two is very important. Now in the police, you might find that's a very difficult conversation to have, because, you know, I can talk about a period where I'm training soldiers versus deploying on operations against the enemy, when failure has some very real consequences, and we wouldn't be sitting down and having a conversation about whether or not it was acceptable or unacceptable failure. In the police force, you're essentially on operations all the time. And so, you know, I had a conversation with a group that I was doing some leadership development work with a few years back, and they were talking about failure as well. They were in banking, and they were kind of saying, well, when's our time to fail safely? You know, we're dealing with people's money. This isn't something that works. But we had a talk through, and they walked away with an idea that actually every single failure does not need to result in somebody getting nailed to the wall for it. Because sometimes that failure allows people to understand where they went wrong and develop. It's a balance. And I think some organizations are more suitable to it than others. I don't think the idea that we would welcome failure in every organization is true. Many absolutely shouldn't welcome failure. I don't think anyone should welcome failure as a single thing. But you need to pick out what can be good from failure. The way that, you know, in the medical world, you would identify when failures happen because they're an opportunity to learn and prevent them happening in future. That's really important. That doesn't mean you pat somebody in the back when they do something terrible in surgery, but it does mean that you understand that you can learn from those mistakes.
Well, in law enforcement, we have something called case law, some of which is over hundreds of years old, guides judges in cases that help them rule and preside over the decisions that they make. The armed services have a long history of military campaigns, which are studied for the same reasons. Is leadership philosophy developed from these campaigns?
One of the constant mantras of the army, and I think of all the armed services in the UK, I think is about learning from our history. And that's not just learning from our history, because it gives us a deep sense of belonging and is part of tradition. It's for really practical reasons. We need to try and learn from every single opportunity that's out there. General Mattis made some very good comments about, you know, the best way to learn from experience is to learn from other people's experience. So, you know, the army, for very obvious reasons, studies previous conflicts to see what it can learn about the art of war. But it also looks at previous leaders and examines previous leaders, because those are really good tools for an individual to learn from. And, you know, the amount of autobiographies and biographies that are out there mean that it's, you know, it's a really popular subject. You can pick a book of your favorite leader, whether or not that's from rugby, football, or, you know, or any kind of background, and help pick out some of those lessons. I think what makes it really valuable in the military is that we go through on many courses the idea that we will pick out a leader, research that leader, and then use current leadership theory as a method of examining them. And that's a common activity on staff courses, that you'll get allocated a leader for you to research, and at the end you have to write a paper on them or give a presentation on them. And that's because by examining previous leaders and running them against a model and working out what worked and what didn't work, you can come up with some conclusions. Not that you necessarily want to be the same as that leader, because you can examine bad leaders through those models as well and learn from it. But by examining them and the historical background, you can learn some lessons about how you want to do things.
I suppose it brings me the question, can you be liked as a leader? You can have some very good leaders but not be liked. And conversely, sometimes you'll have somebody that is loved by the subordinates, but perhaps on a leadership level isn't quite up to the mark.
Yeah, I think if you... I mean, I'm laughing as we talk about this. I think, you know, people say it's called leadership, not likership. And actually, there isn't necessarily a requirement for you to be liked. If you want to make sure that the task is achieved and in the short term, that means that you are putting the task first and the team and the individual come second. The chances are you may not be liked very well, but you will be respected if people understand that you are not in it for yourself. You are still putting the team first, or you know, you're still doing this for the good of the team. People, if the team genuinely come together believing that achieving this task is the most important thing for them, you know, they will give up some of their freedom and give up some of their own wants to achieve the task. And if they accept that, then you may not be well liked for it, but they will respect it and understand it. Now, how achievable that is in the long run, there's another question that, you know, we could perhaps talk about.
Well, I was going to say, you've hit it there, haven't you? You're sort of replacing being liked with being respected.
You know, I think we would all like to work for leaders that we respect. I've worked for leaders that I liked, leaders that I didn't like, and leaders that I respected. And, you know, the like-dislike continuum between the two is not really that relevant. You know, I respected them for their ability. I respected them because they were selfless, they were role models, because they knew their job, and they were able to balance the team, the task, and the individual. It's perhaps a bit trite to say it, but if people can do those things, then you respect them as a leader.
Finally, burnout is an ever-present danger to both police officers and military personnel alike. Not so much PTSD or a reaction to an event, but the daily churn and grind of the task. How do commanders in the field spot these signs, and what sort of checks are put in place?
Yeah, so one of the things that we teach our junior leaders, and I was taught when I was at Sandhurst years ago, it's the importance of looking out for your people, understanding them and looking after them. And okay, sometimes for a junior officer in the army, that's when you're out doing a loaded march, or you've been out on exercise and just sort of stopping your guys and checking their feet, checking they've got blisters, and just, you know, looking after and caring for them physically. Exactly the same thing applies when you're looking after people mentally as well. And you can only do that if you really know your people well. So for me, that is about getting to know people well enough that you understand the signs that they're experiencing stress. Stress in itself is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we like to work in jobs that push us and develop us. I know I certainly do. But, you know, people in the army like to be put in stressful situations. It's kind of why young men continue to join the infantry. And I've always enjoyed those stressful circumstances. But when you know your people well, you know when that stress is becoming too difficult. And men, as you know well, like to bottle these things up. So in terms of dealing with stress in your people, it's absolutely about getting to know them and then having a mechanism whereby you can help them de-stress. And I just go back to this idea of team cohesion. You know, when you get a team that's really tight together, they will look after each other. So the strong team isn't just great for achieving the task, it's great for looking after the individuals, having each other's backs when time gets tough. I go back to the importance of just building a team ready to achieve a task.
And is it important that leaders show the team that they're not invulnerable to stress?
Yeah, I think there's an honesty element as well. And I had a great conversation with a senior exec in a really large company who talked about his mental health issues and his anxiety attacks that he'd suffered as a result of stress. And his view was that by standing up and talking about it and being honest about it, it to some extent normalized it, but it also helped other people understand that this is quite normal and that people can actually have, you know, stressful reactions and still function quite well if they're given the time to recover and be looked after. He had some really, really terrible stress and anxiety and depression. And he always said that by talking about it, for someone out in the audience who was suffering from it but who wasn't willing to talk, it was like somebody throwing a life raft, you know, throwing a life ring out to them, that actually a seriously impressive and successful chief exec of a large international company could stand up and talk about the problems they'd had, proves to other people that actually you can recover from it. And I think that it's important that leaders do that. I don't think this is about always putting on a strong front or necessarily wearing your heart on your sleeve. Again, it's not about being liked, but it is about showing people that actually, you know, in some fairly stressful circumstances that happen in the police and in the military, it's normal to have some kind of stressful reaction to it, and, you know, and share that.
Will Medin, I know you're a very busy man. Thank you for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Dave. Thanks very much.